clean white sheets, he said to Hillo, who merely nodded, blankly. Linen sheets, everyday clean sheets. Hillo maneuvered the bed around and up a step. Being a god, Hillo, continued Odin. Being a god, well, it was unclean, you hear what I'm saying? There was no one who took care of the sheets. I mean, really took care of them. Would you think that, in a situation like mine, father of the gods? There was no one, absolutely no one, who came in and said, Mr. Odwin, he chuckled to himself. They call me Mr. Odwin there, you know. They don't quite know who they're dealing with. I don't think they could handle it, do you, Hillo? But there was no one in all that time who came in and said, Mr. Odwin, I have changed your bed and you have clean sheets. No one. There was constant talk about hewing things and ravaging things and splitting things asunder. Lots of big talk of things being mighty and of things being riven and of things being enthralled to other things, but very little attention given, as I now realize, to the laundry. Let me give you an example. His reminiscences were for a moment interrupted, however, by the arrival of his vehicle at a great doorway, which was guarded by a great sweaty splodge of a being, who stood swaying, arms akimbo, in their path. Torag, who had been preserving an intense silence as he stalked along just ahead of the bed, hurried forward and had a quick word with the sweating creature, who had to bend red-faced to hear him. Then, instantly, the sweaty creature shrank back with glistening obsequiousness into its yellow lair, and the sacred trolley rolled forward into the great halls, chambers, and corridors, from which great, gusty echoes roared and fetid odours blew. "Let me give you an example, Hillo," continued Odin. "Take this place, for example. Take Valhalla." Turning north was a manoeuvre which normally had the effect of restoring a sense of reason and sanity to things, but Dirk could not escape a sense of foreboding. Furthermore, it came on to rain a little, which should have helped, but it was such a mean and wretched rain to come from such a heavy sky that it only increased the sense of claustrophobia and frustration which gripped the night. Dirk turned on the car wipers, which grumbled because they didn't have quite enough rain to wipe away, so he turned them off again. Rain quickly speckled the windscreen. He turned on the wipers again, but they still refused to feel that the exercise was worthwhile, and scraped and squeaked in protest. The streets turned treacherously slippery. Dirk shook his head. He was being quite absurd, he told himself, in the worst possible way. He had allowed himself to become fanciful in a manner that he quite despised. He astounded himself at the wild fantasies he had built on the flimsiest amount of, well, he would hardly call it evidence, mere conjecture. An accident at an airport, probably a simple explanation. Man with a hammer, so what? A grey van which Kate Schechter had seen at the hospital. Nothing unusual about that. Dirk had nearly collided with it, but again, that was a perfectly commonplace occurrence. A Coca-Cola machine. He hadn't taken that into account. Where did a Coca-Cola machine fit into these wild notions about ancient gods? The only idea he had about that was simply too ridiculous for words, and he refused even to acknowledge it to himself. At that point, Dirk found himself driving past the house where, that very morning, he had encountered a client of his, who had had his severed head placed on a revolving record turntable by a green-eyed devil figure waving a scythe and a blood-signed contract, who had then vanished into thin air. He peered at it as he passed, and when a large dark blue BMW pulled out from the curb just ahead of him, he ran straight into the back of it, and for the second time that day he had to leap out of his car already shouting. "For God's sake, can't you look where you're going?" he exclaimed, in the hope of bagging his adversary's best lines from the outset. "Stupid people," he continued, without pausing for breath, "careering all over the place, driving without due care and attention, reckless assault!" "Confuse your enemy," he thought. It was a little like phoning somebody up and saying, "Yes, hello?" in a testy voice when they answered, which was one of Dirk's favourite methods of whiling away long, hot summer afternoons. He bent down and examined the palpable dent in the rear of the BMW, which was quite obviously, damn it, a brand new one. "Blast and bugger it," thought Dirk. "Look what you've done to my bumper," he cried. "I hope you've got a good lawyer." "I am a good lawyer," said a quiet voice, which was followed by a quiet click. Dirk looked up in momentary apprehension. The quiet click was only the sound of the car door closing. The man was wearing an Italian suit, which was also quiet. He had quiet glasses, quietly cut hair, and though a bow tie is not by its very nature a quiet object, the particular bow tie he wore was, nevertheless, a very quietly spotted example of the genre. He drew a slim wallet from his pocket, and also a slim silver pencil. He walked without fuss to the rear of Dirk's Jaguar, and made a note of the registration number. Do you have a card? He inquired as he did so, without looking up. Here's mine, he added, taking one from his wallet. He made a note on the back of it. My registration number, he said, and the name of my insurance company. Perhaps you'd be good enough to let me have the name of yours. If you don't have it with you, I'll get my girl to call you. Dirk sighed and decided there was no point in putting up a fight on this one. He fished out his wallet and leafed through the various business cards that seemed to accumulate in it as if from nowhere. He toyed for a second with the idea of being Wesley Arlott, an ocean-going yacht navigation consultant from, apparently, Arkansas, but then thought better of it. The man had, after all, taken his registration number, and although Dirk had no particular recollection of paying an insurance premium of late, he also had no particular recollection of not paying one either, which was a reasonably promising sign. He handed over a bona fide card with a wince. The man looked at it. Mr. Gently, he said. Private investigator. I'm sorry, private holistic investigator. Okay. He put the card away, taking no further interest. Dirk had never felt so patronized in his life. At that moment, there was another quiet click from the other side of the car. Dirk looked across to see a woman with red spectacles standing there, giving him a frozen half-smile. She was the woman he had spoken with over Geoffrey Anstey's garden wall this morning, and the man, Dirk therefore supposed, was probably her husband. He wondered for a second whether he should wrestle them to the ground and question them rigorously and violently, but he was suddenly feeling immensely tired and run down. He acknowledged the woman in red spectacles with a minute inclination of his head. "Hold on, Cynthia," said the man, and flicked a smile on and off at her. "It's all taken care of." She nodded faintly, and the two of them climbed back into their BMW, and after a moment or two pulled away without fuss, and disappeared away down the road. Dirk looked at the card in his hand. Clive Draycott. He was with a good firm of city solicitors. Dirk stuck the card away in his wallet, climbed despondently back into his car, and drove on to his house, where he found a large golden eagle sitting patiently on his doorstep. Kate rounded on her guest as soon as they were both inside her flat with the door closed, and Kate could be reasonably certain that Neil wasn't going to sneak back out of his flat and lurk disapprovingly halfway up the stairs. The continuing thumping of his bass was at least her guarantee of privacy. "All right," she said fiercely. "So what is the deal with the eagle, then? What is the deal with all the streetlights, huh?" The Norse god of thunder looked at her awkwardly. He had to remove his great horned helmet, because it was banging against the ceiling and leaving scratch marks in the plaster. He tucked it under his arm. "What is the deal," continued Kate, "with the Coca-Cola machine? What is the deal with the hammer? What, in short, is the big deal, huh?" Thor said nothing. He frowned for a second in arrogant irritation, then frowned in something that looked somewhat like embarrassment, and then simply stood there and bled at her. For a few seconds she resisted the impending internal collapse of her attitude, and then realized it was just going to hell anyway, so she might as well get on with it. "Okay," she muttered. "Let's get all that cleaned up. I'll find some antiseptic." She went to rummage in the kitchen cupboard, and returned with a bottle to find Thor saying "no" at her. "No what?" she said crossly, putting the bottle down on the table with a bit of a bang. "That," said Thor, and pushed the bottle back at her. "No." "What's the matter with it?" Thor just shrugged and stared moodily at a corner of the room. There was nothing that could be considered remotely interesting in that corner of the room, so he was clearly looking at it out of sheer bloody-mindedness. "Look, Buster," said Kate, "if I can call you Buster." "What?" "Thor," said Thor. "God of—" "Yes," said Kate. "You told me all the things you're a god of. I'm trying to clean up your arm." "Cedra," said Thor, holding his bleeding arm out, but away from her. He peered at it anxiously. "What?" "Crushed leaves of cedra. Oil of the kernel of the apricot. Infusion of bitter orange blossom. Oil of almonds, sage and comfrey. Not this." He pushed the bottle of antiseptic off the table and sank into a mood. "Right," said Kate, picked up the bottle and hurled it at him. It rebounded off his cheekbone, leaving an instant red mark. Thor lunged forward in a rage, but Kate simply stood her ground with a finger pointed at him. "You stay right there, Buster," she said, and he stopped. "Anything special you need for that?" Thor looked puzzled for a moment. "That," said Kate, pointing at the blossoming bruise on his cheek. "Vengeance," said Thor. "I'll have to see what I can do," said Kate. She turned on her heel and stalked out of the room. After about 2 minutes of unseen activity, Kate returned to the room, trailed by wisps of steam. "All right," she said, "come with me." She led him into her bathroom. He followed her with a great show of reluctance, but he followed her. Kate had been trailed by wisps of steam because the bathroom was full of it. The bath itself was overflowing with bubbles and gunk. There were some bottles and pots, mostly empty, lined up along a small shelf above the bath. Kate picked them up one by one and displayed them at him. "Apricot kernel oil," she said, and turned it upside down to emphasize its emptiness. "All in there," she added, pointing at the foaming bath. "Neroli oil," she said, picking up the next one, "distilled from the blossom of bitter oranges. All in there." She picked up the next one. "Orange cream bath oil. Contains almond oil. All in there." She picked up the pots. "Sage and comfrey," she said of one, "and cedra oil. One of them's a hand cream and the other's hair conditioner, but they're all in there, along with a tube of aloe lip preserver, some cucumber cleansing milk, honeyed beeswax and jojoba oil cleanser, rasool mud, seaweed and birch shampoo, rich night cream with vitamin E, and a very great deal of cod liver oil. I'm afraid I haven't got anything called Vengeance, but here's some Calvin Klein Obsession." She took the stopper from a bottle of perfume and threw the bottle in the bath. "I'll be in the next room when you're done." With that, she marched out and slammed the door on him. She waited in the other room, firmly reading a book. For about a minute, Dirk remained sitting motionless in his car a few yards away from his front door. He wondered what his next move should be. A small, cautious one, he rather thought. The last thing he wanted to have to contend with at the moment was a startled eagle. He watched it intently. It stood there with a pert magnificence about its bearing, its talons gripped tightly around the edge of the stone step. From time to time it preened itself, and then peered sharply up the street and down the street, dragging one of its great talons across the stone in a deeply worrying manner. Dirk admired the creature greatly for its size and its plumage, and its general sense of extreme airworthiness, but asking himself if he liked the way that the light from the street lamp glinted in its great glassy eye, or on the huge hook of its beak, he had to admit that he did not. The beak was a major piece of armoury. It was a beak that would frighten any animal on earth, even one that was already dead and in a tin. Its talons looked as if they could rip up a small Volvo, and it was sitting waiting on Dirk's doorstep, looking up and down the street with a gaze that was at once meaningful and mean. Dirk wondered if he should simply drive off and leave the country. Did he have his passport? No, it was at home. It was behind the door, which was behind the eagle, in a drawer somewhere, or more likely lost. He could sell up. The ratio of estate agents to actual houses in the area was rapidly approaching parity. One of their lot could come and deal with the house. He'd had enough of it, with its fridges and its wildlife, and its ineradical position on the mailing lists of the American Express Company. Or he could, he supposed with a slight shiver, just go and see what it was the eagle wanted. There was a thought. Rats, probably, or a small whippet. All Dirk had, to his knowledge, was some Rice Krispies and an old muffin, and he didn't see those appealing to this magisterial creature of the air. He rather fancied that he could make out fresh blood congealing on the bird's talons, but he told himself firmly not to be so ridiculous. He was just going to have to go and face up to the thing, explain that he was fresh out of rats and take the consequences. Quietly, infinitely quietly, he pushed open the door of his car and stole out of it, keeping his head down. He peered at the eagle from over the bonnet of the car. It hadn't moved. That is to say, it hadn't left the district. It was still looking this way and that around itself with, possibly, a heightened sense of alertness. Dirk didn't know in what remote mountain eyrie the creature had learnt to listen out for the sound of Jaguar car door hinges revolving in their sockets, but the sound had clearly not escaped its attention. Cautiously, Dirk bobbed along behind the line of cars that had prevented him from being able to park directly outside his own house. In a couple of seconds, all that separated him from the extraordinary creature was a small blue Renault. What next? He could simply stand up and, as it were, declare himself. He would be saying, in effect, "Here I am, do what you will." Whatever then transpired, the Renault would probably bear the brunt. There was always the possibility, of course, that the eagle would be pleased to see him, that all the swooping it had been directing at him had been just its way of being matey. Assuming, of course, that it was the same eagle. That was not such an enormous assumption. The number of golden eagles at large in North London at any one time was, Dirk guessed, fairly small. Or maybe it was just resting on his doorstep completely by chance, enjoying a quick breather prior to having another hurtle through the sky in pursuit of whatever it is that eagles hurtle through the sky after. Whatever the explanation, now, Dirk realized, was the time that he had simply to take his chances. He steeled himself, took a deep breath, and arose from behind the Renault, like a spirit rising from the deep. The eagle was looking in another direction at the time, and it was a second or so before it looked back to the front and saw him, at which point it reacted with a loud screech and stepped back an inch or two, a reaction which Dirk felt a little put out by. It then blinked rapidly a few times and adopted a sort of perky expression of which Dirk did not have the faintest idea what to make. He waited for a second or two, until he felt the situation had settled down again after all the foregoing excitement, and then stepped forward tentatively round the front of the Renault. A number of quiet, interrogative cawing noises seemed to float uncertainly through the air, and then, after a moment, Dirk realized that he was making them himself, and made himself stop. This was an eagle he was dealing with, not a budgie. It was at this point that he made his mistake. With his mind entirely taken up with eagles, the possible intentions of eagles, and the many ways in which eagles might be considered to differ from budgies, he did not concentrate enough on what he was doing as he stepped out of the road and onto a pavement that was slick with the recent drizzle. As he brought his rear foot forward, it caught on the bumper of the car. He wobbled, slipped, and did that thing which no one should ever do to a large eagle of uncertain temper, which was to fling himself headlong at it with his arms outstretched. The eagle reacted instantly. Without a second's hesitation, it hopped neatly aside and allowed Dirk the space he needed to collapse heavily onto his own doorstep. It then peered down at him with a scorn that would have withered a lesser man, or at least a man that had been looking up at that moment. Dirk groaned. He had sustained a blow to the temple from the edge of the step, and it was a blow he felt that he could just as easily have done without this evening. He lay there gasping for a second or two, then at last rolled over heavily, clasping one hand to his forehead, the other to his nose, and looked up at the great bird in apprehension, reflecting bitterly on the conditions under which he was expected to work. When it became clear to him that he appeared for the moment to have nothing to fear from the eagle, who was merely regarding him with a kind of quizzical blinking doubt, he sat up, and then slowly dragged himself back to his feet, and wiped and smacked some of the dirt off his coat. Then he hunted through his pockets for his keys, and unlocked the front door, which seemed a little loose. He waited to see what the eagle would do next. With a slight rustle of its wings, it hopped over the lintel and into his hall. It looked around itself, and seemed to regard what it saw with a little distaste. Dirk didn't know what it was that eagles expected of people's hallways, but had to admit to himself that it wasn't only the eagle which reacted like that. The disorder was not that great, but there was a grimness to it, which tended to cast a pall over visitors, and the eagle was clearly not immune to this effect. Dirk picked up a large flat envelope lying on his doormat, looked inside it to check that it was what he had been expecting, and noticed that a picture was missing from the wall. It wasn't a particularly wonderful picture, merely a small Japanese print that he had found in Camden Passage and quite liked, but the point was that it was missing. The hook on the wall was empty. There was a chair missing as well, he realized. The possible significance of this suddenly struck him, and he hurried through to the kitchen. Many of his assorted kitchen implements had clearly gone. The rack of largely unused Sabatier knives, the food processor, and his radio cassette player had all vanished. But he did, however, have a new fridge. It had obviously been delivered by Nobby Paxton's felonious thugs, and he would just have to make the usual little list. Still, he had a new fridge, and that was a considerable load off his mind. Already the whole atmosphere in the kitchen seemed easier. The tension had lifted. There was a new sense of lightness and springiness in the air, which had even communicated itself to the pile of old pizza boxes, which seemed now to recline at a jaunty rather than an oppressive angle. Dirk cheerfully threw open the door to the new fridge, and was delighted to find it completely and utterly empty. Its inner light shone on perfectly clean blue and white walls, and on gleaming chrome shelves. He liked it so much that he instantly determined to keep it like that. He would put nothing in it at all. His food would simply have to go off in plain view. Good. He closed it again. A screech and a flap behind him reminded him that he was entertaining a visiting eagle. He turned to find it glaring at him from on top of the kitchen table. Now that he was getting a little more accustomed to it, and had not actually been viciously attacked as he had suspected he might be, it seemed a little less fearsome than it had at first. It was still a serious amount of eagle, but perhaps an eagle was a slightly more manageable proposition than he had originally supposed. He relaxed a little and took off his hat, pulled off his coat, and threw them onto a chair. The eagle seemed at this juncture to sense that Dirk might be getting the wrong idea about it, and flexed one of its claws at him. With sudden alarm, Dirk saw that it did indeed have something that closely resembled congealed blood on its talons. He backed away from it hurriedly. The eagle then rose up to its full height on its talons, and began to spread its great wings out, wider and wider, beating them very slowly, and leaning forward so as to keep its balance. Dirk did the only thing he could think of to do under the circumstances, and bolted from the room, slamming the door behind him and jamming the hall table up against it. A terrible cacophony of screeching and scratching and buffeting arose instantly from behind it. Dirk sat leaning back against the table, panting and trying to catch his breath. and then, after a while, began to get a worrying feeling about what the bird was up to now. It seemed to him that the eagle was actually dive-bombing itself against the door. Every few seconds the pattern would repeat itself. First a great beating of wings, then a rush, then a terrible cracking thud. Dirk didn't think it would get through the door, but was alarmed that it might beat itself to death trying. The creature seemed to be quite frantic about something, but what, Dirk could not even begin to imagine. He tried to calm himself down and think clearly, to work out what he should do next. He should phone Kate and make certain she was all right. Whoosh! Thud! He should finally open up the envelope he had been carrying with him all day and examine its contents. Whoosh! Thud! For that, he would need a sharp knife. Whoosh! Thud! Three rather awkward thoughts then struck him in fairly quick succession. First, the only sharp knives in the place, assuming Nobby's removal people had left him with any at all, were in the kitchen. Whoosh! Thud! That didn't matter so much in itself, because he could probably find something in the house that would do. Whoosh! Thud! The second thought was that the actual envelope itself was in the pocket of his coat, which he had left lying over the back of a chair in the kitchen. Whoosh! Thud! The third thought was very similar to the second, and had to do with the location of the piece of paper with Kate's telephone number on it. Whoosh! Thud! Oh, God! Dirk began to feel very, very tired at the way the day was working out. He was deeply worried by the sense of impending calamity, but was still by no means able to divine what lay at the root of it. Whoosh! Thud! Well, he knew what he had to do now. Whoosh! Thud! So there was no point in not getting on with it. He quietly pulled the table away from the door. Whoosh! He ducked and yanked the door open, passing smoothly under the eagle as it hurtled out into the hallway and hit the opposite wall. He slammed the door closed behind him from inside the kitchen, pulled his coat off the chair, and jammed the chair back up under the handle. Whoosh! Thud! The damage done to the door on this side was both considerable and impressive, and Dirk began seriously to worry about what this behaviour said about the bird's state of mind, or what the bird's state of mind might become if it maintained this behaviour for very much longer. Whoosh! Scratch! The same thought seemed to have occurred to the bird at that moment, and after a brief flurry of screeching and scratching at the door with its talons, it lapsed into a grumpy and defeated silence, which, after it had been going on for about a minute, became almost as disturbing as the previous batterings. Dirk wondered what it was up to. He approached the door cautiously, and very, very quietly, moved the chair back a little, so that he could see through the keyhole. He squatted down and peered through it. At first it seemed to him that he could see nothing through it, that it must be blocked by something. Then a slight flicker and glint close up on the other side suddenly revealed the startling truth, which was that the eagle also had an eye up at the keyhole and was busy looking back at him. Dirk almost toppled backwards with the shock of the realization, and backed away from the door with a sense of slight horror and revulsion. This was extremely intelligent behaviour for an eagle, wasn't it? Was it? How could he find out? He couldn't think of any ornithological experts to phone. All his reference books were piled up in other rooms of the house, and he didn't think he'd be able to keep on pulling off the same stunt with impunity, certainly not when he was dealing with an eagle which had managed to figure out what keyholes were for. He retreated to the kitchen sink and found some kitchen towel. He folded it into a wad, soaked it, and dabbed it first on his bleeding temple, which was swelling up nicely, and then on his nose, which was still very tender, and had been a considerable size for most of the day now. Maybe the eagle was an eagle of delicate sensibilities, and had reacted badly to the sight of Dirk's face in its current much-abused state, and had simply lost its mind. Dirk sighed and sat down. Kate's telephone, which was the next thing he turned his attention to, was answered by a machine when he tried to ring it. Her voice told him, very sweetly, that he was welcome to leave a message after the beep, but warned that she hardly ever listened to them, and that it was much better to talk to her directly, only he couldn't because she wasn't in, so he'd best try again. Thank you very much, he thought, and put the phone down. He realized that the truth of the matter was this. He had spent the day putting off opening the envelope because of what he was worried about finding in it. It wasn't that the idea was frightening, though indeed it was frightening that a man should sell his soul to a green-eyed man with a scythe, which is what circumstances were trying very hard to suggest had happened. It was just that it was extremely depressing that he should sell it to a green-eyed man with a scythe in exchange for a share in the royalties of a hit record. That was what it looked like on the face of it, wasn't it? Dirk picked up the other envelope, the one which had been waiting for him on his doormat, delivered there by a courier from a large London bookshop, where Dirk had an account. He pulled out the contents, which were a copy of the sheet music of Hot Potato, written by Colin Paynton, Phil Mulville, and Jeff Anstey. The lyrics were, well, straightforward. They provided a basic repetitive bit of funk rhythm and a simple sense of menace and cheerful callousness which had caught the mood of last summer. They went, Hot potato, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. Quick, pass it on, pass it on, pass it on. You don't want to get caught, get caught, get caught. Drop it on someone, who, anybody. You better not have it when the big one comes. I said you better not have it when the big one comes. It's a hot potato. And so on. The repeated phrases got tossed backwards and forwards between the two members of the band. The drum machine got heavier and heavier, and there had been a dance video. Was that all it was going to be? Big deal. A nice house in Lupton Street with polyurethane floors and a broken marriage? Things had certainly come down a long way since the great days of Faust and Mephistopheles, when a man could gain all the knowledge of the universe, achieve all the ambitions of his mind, and all the pleasures of the flesh for the price of his soul. Now it was a few record royalties, a few pieces of trendy furniture, a trinket to stick on your bathroom wall, and whap, your head comes off. So what exactly was the deal? What was the potato contract? Who was getting what, and why? Dirk rummaged through a drawer for the bread knife, sat down once more, took the envelope from his coat pocket, and ripped through the congealed strata of scotch tape which held the end of it together. Out fell a thick bundle of papers. At exactly the moment that the telephone rang, the door to Kate's sitting room opened. The Thunder God attempted to stomp in through it, but in fact he wafted. He had clearly soaked himself very thoroughly in the stuff Kate had thrown into the bath, then redressed, and torn up a nightgown of Kate's to bind his forearm with. He casually tossed a handful of softened oak shards away into the corner of the room. Kate decided for the moment to ignore both the deliberate provocations and the telephone. The former she could deal with, and the latter she had a machine for dealing with. "I've been reading about you," she challenged the Thunder God. "Where's your beard?" He took the book, a one-volume encyclopedia, from her hands, and glanced at it before tossing it aside contemptuously. "Ha!" he said. "I shaved it off when I was in Wales." He scowled at the memory. "What were you doing in Wales, for heaven's sake?" "Counting the stones," he said with a shrug, and went to stare out of the window. There was a huge, moping anxiety in his bearing. It suddenly occurred to Kate, with a spasm of something not entirely unlike fear, that sometimes when people got like that, it was because they had picked up their mood from the weather. With the Thunder God, it presumably worked the other way round. The sky outside certainly had a restless and disgruntled look. Her reaction suddenly started to become very confused. "Excuse me if this sounds like a stupid question," said Kate, "but I'm a little at sea here. I'm not used to spending the evening with someone who's got a whole day named after them. What stones were you counting in Wales?" "All of them," said Thor with a low growl. "All of them between this size," he held the tip of his forefinger and thumb about a quarter of an inch apart, "and this size," he held his two hands about a yard apart, and then put them down again. Kate stared at him blankly. "Well, how many were there?" she asked. It seemed only polite to ask. He rounded on her angrily. "Count them yourself if you want to know," he shouted. "What's the point in my spending years and years and years counting them so that I'm the only person who knows, and who will ever know, if I just go and tell somebody else? Well?" He turned back to the window. "Anyway," he said, "I've been a bit worried about it. I think I may have lost count somewhere in Mid-Glamorgan, but I'm not," he shouted, "going to do it again." "Well, why on earth would you do such an extraordinary thing in the first place?" "It was a burden placed on me by my father. A punishment. A penance." He glowered. "Your father?" said Kate. "Do you mean Odin?" "The All-Father," said Thor. "Father of the gods of Asgard."
"And you're saying he's alive?"
Thor turned to look at her as if she was stupid. "We are immortals," he said simply. Downstairs, Neil chose that moment to conclude his thunderous performance on the bass, and the house seemed to sing in its aftermath with an eerie silence. "Immortals are what you wanted," said Thor in a low, quiet voice. "Immortals are what you got. It is a little hard on us. You wanted us to be forever, so we are forever. Then you forget about us. But still, we are forever. Now at last many are dead, many dying." He then added in a quiet voice, "But it takes a special effort."
"I can't even begin to understand what you're talking about," said Kate. "You say that we...
"You can begin to understand," said Thor angrily, "which is why I've come to you. Do you know that most people hardly see me, hardly notice me at all? It is not that we are hidden. We are here, we move among you,
My people, your gods. You gave birth to us. You made us be what you would not dare to be yourselves. Yet you will not acknowledge us. If I walk along one of your streets in this world you have made for yourselves without us, then barely an eye will once flicker in my direction. Is this when you're wearing your helmet? Especially when I'm wearing the helmet. Well, you make fun of me, roared Thor. You make it very easy for a girl, said Kate. I don't know what. Suddenly the room seemed to quake, and then to catch its breath. All of Kate's insides wobbled violently, and then held very still. In the sudden, horrible silence, a blue china table lamp slowly toppled off the table, hit the floor, and crawled off to a dark corner of the room, where it sat in a worried little defensive huddle. Kate stared at it and tried to be calm about it. She felt as if cold, soft jelly was trickling down her skin. "Did you do that?" she said shakily. Thor was looking livid and confused. He muttered, "Do not make me angry with you. You were very lucky." He looked away. "What are you saying?" "I'm saying that I wish you to come with me."
"What? What about that?"
She pointed at the small, befuddled kitten under the table, which had so recently and so confusingly been a blue china table lamp. "There's nothing I can do for it." Kate was suddenly so tired and confused and frightened that she found she was nearly in tears. She stood biting her lip and trying to be as angry as she could. "Oh, yeah," she said. "I thought you were meant to be a god. I hope you haven't got into my home under false pretenses. I..." She stumbled to a halt and then resumed in a different tone of voice. "Do you mean," she said in a small voice, "that you have been here in the world all this time?" "Here and in Asgard," said Thor. "Asgard," said Kate. "The home of the gods?" Thor was silent. It was a grim silence that seemed to be full of something that bothered him deeply. "Where is Asgard?" demanded Kate. Again Thor did not speak. He was a man of very few words and enormously long pauses. When at last he did answer, it wasn't at all clear whether he had been thinking all that time, or just standing there. "Asgard is also here," he said. "All worlds are here." He drew out from under his furs his great hammer, and studied its head deeply, and with an odd curiosity, as if something about it was very puzzling. Kate wondered where she found such a gesture familiar from. She found that it instinctively made her want to duck. She stepped back very slightly, and was watchful. When he looked up again, there was an altogether new focus and energy in his eyes, as if he was gathering himself up to hurl himself at something. "Tonight, I must be in Asgard," he said. "I must confront my father Odin in the great hall of Valhalla, and bring him to account for what he has done."
"You mean for making you count Welsh pebbles?"
"No," said Thor. "For making the Welsh pebbles not worth counting." Kate shook her head in exasperation.
"I simply don't know what to make of you at all," she said. "I think I'm just too tired. Come back tomorrow, explain it all in the morning."
"No," said Thor. "You must see Asgard yourself, and then you will understand. You must see it tonight."
He gripped her by the arm.
"I don't want to go to Asgard," she insisted. "I don't want to go to mythical places with strange men. You go, call me up and tell me how it went in the morning. Give him hell about the pebbles." She wrested her arm from his grip. It was very, very clear to her that she only did this with his permission. "Now please go and let me sleep." She glared at him. At that moment the house seemed to erupt as Neil launched into a thumping bass rendition of Siegfried's Rheinfahrt from Act I of Götterdämmerung, just to prove it could be done. The walls shook, the windows rattled. From under the table the sound of the table lamp, mewing pathetically, could just be heard. Kate tried to maintain her furious glare, but it simply couldn't be kept up for very long in the circumstances. "Okay," she said at last, "how do we get to this place?" "There are as many ways as there are tiny pieces."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Tiny things." He held up his thumb and forefinger again to indicate something very small. "Molecules," he said, seeming to be uncomfortable with the word. "But first let us leave here."
"Will I need a coat in Asgard?"
"As you wish."
"Well, I'll take one anyway. Wait a minute."
She decided that the best way to deal with the astonishing rigmarole which currently constituted her life was to be businesslike about it. She found her coat, brushed her hair, left a new message on the telephone answering machine, and put a saucer of milk firmly under the table. "Right," she said, and led the way out of the flat, locking it carefully after them, and making shushing noises as they passed Neil's door. For all the uproar he was currently making, He was almost certainly listening out for the slightest sound, and would be out in a moment if he heard them going by, to complain about the Coca-Cola machine. The lateness of the hour, man's inhumanity to man, the weather, the noise, and the colour of Kate's coat, which was a shade of blue that Neil, for some reason, disapproved of most particularly. They still passed successfully, and closed the front door behind them, with the merest click. The sheets which tumbled out onto Dirk's kitchen table were made of thick, heavy paper, folded together, and had obviously been much handled. He sorted them out, one by one, separating them from each other, smoothing them out with the flat of his hand, and laying them out neatly in rows on the kitchen table, clearing a space, as it became necessary, among the old newspapers, ashtrays, and dirty cereal bowls, which Alina the cleaner always left exactly where they were, claiming, when challenged on this, that she thought he had put them there specially. He pored over the papers for several minutes, moving from one to another, comparing them with each other, studying them carefully, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, line by line. He couldn't understand a word of them. It should have occurred to him, he realized, that the green-eyed, hairy, scythe-waving giant might differ from him not only in general appearance and personal habits, but also in such matters as the alphabet he favored. He sat back in his seat, disgruntled and thwarted, and reached for a cigarette, but the packet in his coat was now empty. He picked up a pencil and tapped it in a cigarette-like way, but it wasn't able to produce the same effect. After a minute or two, he became acutely conscious of the fact that he was probably still being watched through the keyhole by the eagle, and he found that this made it impossibly hard to concentrate on the problem before him, particularly without a cigarette. He scowled to himself. He knew there was still a packet upstairs by his bed, but he didn't think he could handle the sheer ornithology involved in going to get it. He tried to stare at the papers for a little longer. The writing, apart from being written in some kind of small, crabby, and indecipherable runic script, was mostly hunched up towards the left-hand side of the paper, as if swept there by a tide. The right-hand side was largely clear, except for an occasional group of characters which were lined up underneath each other. All of it, except for a slight sense of indefinable familiarity about the layout, was completely meaningless to Dirk. He turned his attention back to the envelope instead, and tried once more to examine some of the names which had been so heavily crossed out. Howard Bell, the incredibly wealthy best-selling novelist, who wrote bad books which sold by the warehouse load, despite, or perhaps because of, the fact that nobody read them. Dennis Hutch, record company magnate. Now that he had a context for the name, Dirk knew it perfectly well. The Aries Rising record group, which had been founded on 60s ideals, or at least what passed for ideals in the 60s, grown in the 70s, and then embraced the materialism of the 80s without missing a beat, was now a massive entertainment conglomerate on both sides of the Atlantic. Dennis Hutch had stepped up into the top seat when its founder had died of a lethal overdose of brick wall, taken while under the influence of a Ferrari and a bottle of tequila. ARG was also the record label on which Hot Potato had been released. Stan Dubček, senior partner in the advertising company with the silly name, which now owned most of the British and American advertising companies, which had not had names which were quite as silly, and had therefore been swallowed whole. And here, suddenly, was another name that was instantly recognisable, now that Dirk was attuned to the sort of names he should be looking for. Roderick Mercer, the world's greatest publisher of the world's sleaziest newspapers. Dirk hadn't at first spotted the name with the unfamiliar Urich in place after the Rod. Well, well, well. Now here were people, thought Dirk suddenly, who had really got something. Certainly they'd got rather more than a nice little house in Lupton Road with some dried flowers lying around the place. They also had the great advantage of having heads on their shoulders as well, unless Dirk had missed something new and dramatic on the news. What did all that mean? What was this contract? How come everybody whose hands it had been through had been so astoundingly successful except for one, Geoffrey Anstey? Everybody whose hands it had passed through had benefited from it except for the one who had it last, who had still got it. It was a hot potato. You better not have it when the big one comes. The notion suddenly formed in Dirk's mind that it might have been Geoffrey Anstey himself who had overheard a conversation about a hot potato, about getting rid of it, passing it on. If he remembered correctly the interview he had read with Payne, he didn't say that he himself had overheard the conversation. You better not have it when the big one comes. The notion was a horrible one, and ran on like this. Geoffrey Anstey had been pathetically naive. He had overheard this conversation between... who? Dirk picked up the envelope and ran over the list of names, and had thought that it had a good dance rhythm. He had not for a moment realized that what he was listening to was a conversation that would result in his own hideous death. He'd got a hit record out of it, and when the real hot potato was actually handed to him, he had picked it up. Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. And instead of taking the advice he had recorded in the words of the song, quick, pass it on, pass it on, pass it on, he had stuck it behind the gold record award on his bathroom wall. You better not have it when the big one comes. Dirk frowned and took a long, slow, thoughtful drag on his pencil. This was ridiculous. He had to get some cigarettes if he was going to think this thing through with any intellectual rigour. He pulled on his coat, stuffed his hat on his head, and made for the window. The window hadn't been opened for, well, certainly not during his ownership of the house, and it struggled and screamed at the sudden unaccustomed invasion of its space and independence. Once he had forced it wide enough, Dirk struggled out onto the windowsill, pulling swathes of leather coat out with him. From here it was a bit of a jump to the pavement, since there was a lower ground floor to the house, with a narrow flight of steps leading down to it in the front. A line of iron railings separated these from the pavement, and Dirk had to get clear over these. Without hesitating for a moment, he made the jump, and it was in mid-bound that he realised he had not picked up his car keys from the kitchen table where he had left them. He considered, as he sailed gracelessly through the air, whether or not to execute a wild mid-air twist, make a desperate grab backwards for the window, and hope that he might just manage to hold on to the sill, but decided on mature reflection that an error at this point might just conceivably kill him, whereas the walk would probably do him good. He landed heavily on the far side of the railings, but the tails of his coat became entangled with them, and he had to pull them off, tearing part of the lining in the process. Once the ringing shock in his knees had subsided, and he had recovered what little composure the events of the day had left him with, he realised that it was now well after 11 o'clock, and the pubs would be shut, and he might have a longer walk than he had bargained for to find some cigarettes. He considered what to do. The current outlook and state of mind of the Eagle was a major factor to be taken into account here. The only way to get his car keys now was back through the front door into his eagle-infested hallway. Moving with great caution, he tiptoed back up the steps to his front door, squatted down, and, hoping that the damn thing wasn't going to squeak, gently pushed up the flap of the letterbox and peered through. In an instant, a talon was hooked into the back of his hand, and a great screeching beak slashed at his eye, narrowly missing it, but scratching a great gouge across his much-abused nose. Dirk howled with pain and lurched backwards, not getting very far, because he still had a talon hooked in his hand. He lashed out desperately and hit at the talon, which hurt him considerably, dug the sharp point even further into his flesh, and caused a great barging flurry on the other side of the door, each tiniest movement of which tugged heavily in his hand. He grabbed at the great claw with his free hand and tried to tug it back out of himself. It was immensely strong, and was shaking with the fury of the Eagle, which was as trapped as he was. At last, quivering with pain, he managed to release himself, and pulled his injured hand back, nursing and cuddling it with the other. The Eagle pulled its claw back sharply, and Dirk heard it flapping away back down his hallway, emitting terrible screeches and cries, its great wings colliding with and scraping the walls. Dirk toyed with the idea of burning the house down, but once the throbbing in his hand had begun to subside a little, he calmed down and tried, if he could, to see things from the Eagle's point of view. He couldn't. He had not the faintest idea how things appeared to eagles in general, much less to this particular eagle, which seemed to be a seriously deranged example of the species. After a minute or so more of nursing his hand, curiosity, allied to a strong sense that the eagle had definitely retreated to the far end of the hall and stayed there, overcame him, and he bent down once more to the letterbox. This time he used his pencil to push the flap back upwards, and scanned the hallway from a safe position, a good few inches back. The eagle was clearly in view, perched on the end of the banister rail, regarding him with resentment and opprobrium, which Dirk felt was a little rich coming from a creature which had only a moment or two earlier been busily engaged in trying to rip his hand off. Then, once the eagle was certain that it had got Dirk's attention, it slowly raised itself up on its feet, and slowly shook its great wings out, beating them gently for balance. It was this gesture that had previously caused Dirk to bolt prudently from the room. This time, however, he was safely behind a couple of good solid inches of wood, and he stood, or rather squatted, his ground. The eagle stretched its neck upwards as well, jabbing its tongue out at the air and cawing plaintively, which surprised Dirk. Then he noticed something else rather surprising about the eagle, which was that its wings had strange, un-eagle-like markings on them. They were large, concentric circles. The differences of coloration which delineated the circles were very slight, and it was only the absolute geometric regularity of them which made them stand out as clearly as they did. Dirk had the very clear sense that the eagle was showing him these circles, and that that was what it had wanted to attract his attention to all along. Each time the bird had dived at him, he realized, as he thought back, it had then started on a strange kind of flapping routine, which had involved opening its wings right out. However, each time it had happened, Dirk had been too busily engaged with the business of turning round and running away to pay this exhibition the appropriate attention.